Vacation starts with VA. One thing you'll love about your trip to Virginia is that you'll never have to settle for one thing. All that you love is all in one trip. Start yours at virginia.org.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Last night in primetime, the Select Committee to Investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol held its last public hearing for now. And the committee's focus last night was a minute-by-minute accounting of President Trump's actions in the West Wing as the violence at the Capitol was unfolding. We heard previously unheard testimony from a number of national security officials working in the White House. We heard a harrowing account of Secret Service agents at the Capitol fearing for their lives and broadcasting messages to loved ones over their radios. And we heard raw tape of President Trump working through revisions of the Rose Garden statement that ultimately asked rioters to go home, calling them, quote, very special people, and in which he repeats his lie about the election fraud. And we see that even after the worst of the violence, that he can't bring himself to condemn it or to say that he lost the election, despite his aides urging. Joining us now to recap some of what we heard from the committee last night is Karen J. Greenberg, the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law. Her latest book is Subtle Tools, The Dismantling of American Democracy from the War on Terror to Donald Trump. Karen, welcome back to All of It.
Thanks so much for having me.
And listeners, any questions about what you heard at last night's hearing or about the overall efforts to bring accountability for the Capitol riot? We can take your questions for Karen Greenberg. Give us a call at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Or you can let us know via social media. Our handle is at all of it, WNYC. Karen, let's start with the witnesses. Sarah Matthews, a former White House deputy press secretary, and Matt Pottinger, Mr. Trump's former deputy national security advisor. Why did the committee want us to hear from these particular witnesses?
You know, that's a very good question. But what they really wanted, I mean, there are a lot of reasons. They wanted people who had been inside the White House for the duration of what happened that day, for those 187 minutes. The lens has gotten increasingly narrow and focused over the course of these eight hearings. And so it's gone from sort of the broad national picture to the Washington, D.C. picture to the Capitol picture. And now they really wanted it to be focused inside the White House. So in terms of just the optics of it, they wanted that. They also wanted people who were loyal to Donald Trump up until that moment, when they got to a moment where each of them, as well as others, had to resign. And part of the narrative that was built last night, very effectively, I think, was using Republicans and Republican wording and Republicans who have even later reneged on it in some cases, to note that that moment was an unacceptable moment in the way the president was behaving. And so I think those are, you know, the two larger reasons, and then the specifics of their jobs. One was deputy national security advisor, who was the person in the White House that day because national security advisor O'Brien was gone. And the other one, also who had been with Trump for a long time and in the White House, and declared herself a Republican, was in charge of many things, including some of the communications. And so part of the narrative was, why was the president so isolated? Why did he not go into the press room when it's there and mic'd and ready all day long? What happened? And so they were able to tell this narrative from the optics of inside the White House and without any ego in the game, which other kinds of officials might have had. So I thought that was interesting.
Putting your legal hat on, what has to happen in the eyes of the law for somebody's inaction to rise to the level of criminality?
So I'm more a historian, but I can tell you that the criminality issue here is what they were trying to do yesterday. And this is something that legal scholars have been debating, is to establish the frame, the mindset that Trump brought to this. What is his, what was the, what did he know? When did he know it? And what did that mean in terms of his intent? Because what they're trying to do is to tell this narrative that goes from, was it just inaction, or was that action something that exacerbated the violence? And the narrative yesterday was very much that he knew it was an armed mob, which we've learned before this, that he knew they were storming the Capitol, that he knew that he knew they were, in response to his tweet, as we learned last night, threatening the life of Mike Pence, and that he was exacerbating the conversation and the tenor and the and really the violence itself. And he was doing it in a knowing way. And that is what they're trying to, if it ever gets to a legal proceeding, that is what that will be an important fundamental for lawyers going forward. Not the only one, but a very important one.
We'd love to take your calls at WNYC for Karen Greenberg, who's the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law. We're talking about last night's hearings of the January 6th special committee. Let's talk with Carol in Ocean Grove. Hi, Carol. You're on the air.
Hi. My question, and it, for a while now, has been, has there been anything revealed about the allegations of some of these rioters having been given tours of the Capitol days prior to January 6th?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I think a couple of weeks ago, they sort of filled in some of the details. I do think they know who some of the congresspersons were. I wouldn't be surprised if this is something that we would see more of in September, but we're still very murky on the details. But the fact that there were tours, that there was some kind of inside association between congresspersons and the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, prior to January 6th, it seems to be a narrative that's still playing out. So, and I think it's going to prove to be very important, because in addition to talking about White House liaisons and White House enabling the rioters, there's also the issue of who in Congress was doing this and what that might mean going forward for those individuals.
Thanks for your call, Carol. Karen, let's talk about the public-facing actions that the president did take, which, as we know, took the form of several tweets and a video statement shot in the Rose Garden. And we all watched those messages come out on that day. So, you know, they're not new pieces of evidence. But what struck you differently about those messages when they were put in the context that the committee placed them in?
Timing. Timing is everything, and chronology. So, you know, you have his tweet about Mike Pence, right? And then within 2 minutes, you have the violence against Mike Pence escalating, right? So, and I think we saw that. We saw that in prior hearings as well. But this connection in terms of, it's not just what he said and, oh, that was a message that was out there. Should they pick it up? The rioters were watching their phones. They were reading the tweets. They were waiting for the encouragement, the direction. And I thought last night made that very clear by tying the tweets to the action, most notably with the threats on Pence, but not only. And notice at the end, when he did say, you know, it's time to go home, we love you, but it's time to go home, they backed away. They began to move away. So the immediacy of the message being received, I thought, was made very clear last night in a way that I actually hadn't quite absorbed prior to that.
The committee also played raw footage of Trump's attempt to record that Rose Garden message, where he finally told, as we've just mentioned, the rioters to go home. What should we take away from having seen the sort of self-editing that the president was doing?
The real takeaway is his absolute refusal to actually embrace the idea that the election was over. He did not want to say the election was over. He would say he did not want to castigate the rioters. He was willing to use the word peaceful, being encouraged to do so by his daughter. But in terms of assigning blame, in terms of recognizing the magnitude of what was happening, in terms of doing anything that would address the narrative of election fraud, He wasn't willing to do that, nor was he willing to do it the next day when we saw the speech that he taped out the next day. And to this day, he's not willing to do it. And I think that was the moment in which it was clear that he was only going to go so far in backing away from those rioters and their intentions.
Let's go to Jim in Bricktown, New Jersey. Hi, Jim. Welcome to All of It.
Oh, thank you. I was wondering just legally what is necessary for eliminating Trump for eligibility for a second term. If he had been impeached, that would have been it. But I've heard various things where either a state or federal trial, that a convicted felon can be in the Oval Office. I've heard different variations on that.
That is a really good question. And I'm so glad you raised that about the impeachment and the Senate's decision not to convict him in a trial, because it would have answered that question. Now we face who knows. Yes, I think that there are a number of things afoot right now that are moving towards the idea that he can't run again. I think that Attorney General Merrick Garland's memo saying that, you know, a candidate we can't get into the politics of a candidacy going forward was not helpful in the direction of trying to figure out what could stop him from running again. There are many different ways that prosecutors and others could argue this, but is there a slam dunk that's in our sights? Nobody's really weighed in on that yet, but I think you're right. I think this is where lawyers are looking right now, but there's no easy solution to this. And if there were, we would know.
Karen, we heard committee members refer repeatedly to the oath of office. How legally binding is an oath, if at all?
It's completely binding. why do we have Article 2 of the Constitution? Why do we have a constitution? You know, when you ask how binding it is, you're raising a very deep question about leadership and leaders. And that is, does all of the framework of our government depend on good people? What if bad people are in office? What if people who betray their oath are in office? The oath that he took, which was to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, is sacred. It has been sacred since the beginning of the country, and that's why the comments about redirecting the narrative after this about what the president can and can't do and how the country defends itself is so very important. Something that General Milley addressed during the clips that were shown yesterday.
Well, let's hear a clip of General Mark Milley. As we know, he's the chairman was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he testified to the committee that Mike Pence had called for the National Guard to help secure the Capitol. Here's how he described his call with Trump's chief of staff, Mark Meadows.
He said, we have to kill the narrative that the vice president is making all the decisions. We need to establish the narrative that, that the president is still in charge and that things are steady or stable or what's that thing. I immediately interpret that as politics, politics, politics. Red flag for me personally, no action, but I remember it distinctly. I don't do political narratives.
That's General Mark Milley. This discussion about who is in charge, the president or the vice president or Senators Schumer and McConnell, who we heard coordinating with Capitol Security mm-hmm. personnel, can you clarify a little bit of how this fits in with the idea that the president was derelict in his duties?
100%. And I think actually that may be the biggest takeaway from last night's hearing is the dereliction, changing the narrative to dereliction of duty just from, you know, exacerbating the crowd, condoning violence, instigating violence, as some would argue. I think this idea of dereliction of duty was new and central to how the understanding of what happened is going to go forward. What became clear through the clips that you just mentioned, including Schumer and others, bipartisan, trying to figure out what to do, was that there was no one in charge in Washington for 3 hours. That's a frightening fact and something that should not have happened and should not happen again. The president was there. He isolated himself in the dining room, watching Fox News, no phone logs, no presidential diary. The White House photographer was forbidden to take pictures. And advisors everywhere, lawyers, family members, staff members, telling him to please send out a tweet showing his leadership, or to make a statement or to something. And he didn't do anything. And so we really were leaderless. And that is something that I think Mark Milley was trying to get at, which is that this can't happen, that we don't have, that there's a breakdown that's this complete. We have to have a system that will function. And I thought that was actually one of the most important takeaways from yesterday.
Karen Greenberg is my guest. She's the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law. We're talking about last night's hearings of the January 6th committee. If you have a question for her, give us a call. Our number is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Karen, I'm no legal expert, but a quick Google search shows that dereliction of duty is a specific charge in the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Could Trump, as the former commander-in-chief, face charges in a military court? And what would that look like?
That is beyond my my vision. I can't imagine that. Yes, you could try that. But listen, let me put this in another context. We shouldn't having to be looking for minute little ways to find alternate courts or alternate ways to try the president. This is a person who tried to conduct a coup with an armed group against the fundamental premise of democracy, which was certification of the election. And so the idea that we're trying to find these little things, no, this should be something that the Department of Justice handles, that they amass the facts, that they put together a case, and that they bring charges where they can. And so your question, I mean, I understand it, and there's been other tweaks on it, which is, well, how could we do this? No, this has to be done in a very fulsome, aggressive way that, to follow what Mark Milley was saying, but apply it to the Department of Justice, that our Department of Justice works. And as Attorney General Garland said the other day, that no one is above the law. So I hope that doesn't dash your hopes for the military commission.
Let's go to Ted in Manhattan. Hi, Ted. Welcome to All of It.
Hello, Karen and Carrie. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a quick question about the call log and the visitor log, and you just touched on it a minute ago, but I felt that that was something that was unresolved, and maybe I missed it during the broadcast last night, but just wanted to check with you on that, and I'll take my answer off the phone.
So I think your question is basically, did they resolve how that happened or why that happened? In which case, that is not the case. But let me tell you something about the Trump years. The absence of logs, of records, is something that well predated January 6th. It was actually something that I think is characteristic of the Trump administration and had been throughout. We've seen it before with the attempt to, hide or not create the White House visitors' logs. These are something that the president is required to do. It also speaks to the issue of the Trump administration refusing to turn over White House records generally to the National Security Archives. Now, something that we're seeing with the Secret Service. There was talk about a dereliction of duty in a different way. There was a deep sense in the Trump administration that the best way to have secrecy was not to have to keep something secret by not creating the record. And we saw innumerable instances of this. And so I'm glad you pointed to this coming up last night.
I want to jump back a little to the Secret Service, if we could. Over the past few weeks, it's been reported that the National Archives discovered that some Secret Service text messages had been deleted after the archives had specifically asked them to retain all the records. So far, the committee has depicted a Secret Service that was kind of afraid for their lives in the moment and who were really doing all they could to protect the vice president. So what stands out to you about this Secret Service thread of the story?
You're right. You've given sort of the good and the bad of it. The fate of the country hinged on maybe that conversation we heard about in The Beast that we heard about from Cassidy Hutchinson. At the same time, they deleted these communications. And so, you know, which is it? Were they defending the country or who are they defending? And again, the Secret Service has said that this all happened because of a technical glitch in moving from one platform to another platform or one service to another service. But what stands out to me is what I was saying before. There was a tolerance for the technique or strategy of erasing the record during the Trump administration. And the Secret Service does not seem to have been immune from that.
It's supposed to be a process that's quarantined, you know, from the politics of going on in the country. But a lot of political reporters have started asking Republican operatives when they think Trump might announce he's running in 2024. And we've got midterms in November of this year, 2 months after the committee wants to resume these public hearings. So from your national security perspective, how are you thinking about those political elements?
You know, this is very complicated. I think that worrying too much about politics and making it too broad, a broader brush to paint this with could be very dangerous. I think we need to see the January 6th as a trial run that didn't work, and it could happen again. I think that one thing the January 6th committee has done is expose the vulnerabilities of why it only got so far. I think that that to say it can't be politics is sort of missing the point, which is that this is all about politics. And this is a new chapter in American, you know, national security policy, but also executive policy and just how we function as a country. Is the word politics can't just shut down justice, fairness, protection of the Constitution, protection of the democracy. And so I think we really have to be aware of that word as a word that's used to shut down conversation rather than to open it up.
Let's go to Stephen in Harlem. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to All of It.
Thank you very much for taking my call. Yes. You know, Merrick Garland's statement aside, it seems to me that the ex-president has avoided any kind of culpability for years. And what I see is, again, that what do you guys think about the odds that he's just going to skate again? I personally believe he's going to be reinstalled one way or the other in 2024, a very frightening proposition for the country or what's going to be left of the country when it all is concluded. So I was just thinking, you know, what do you think about that as far as it goes, you know, that he's going to, that it's all going to just blow by like everything else?
that's the elephant in the room question, right? You know, I sort of make it a professional principle to hope for the best, but not just to hope for the best, to try to figure out what can be done to make sure the best happens. So the idea of Trump in 2024 is something I think can be stopped, I think is the best way to say it. I think it can be stopped legally. I think it can be stopped politically. I think, I think we all know what that will take in terms of some aggressive behavior on the part of this administration and the Democratic Party, and even some Republicans. One of the things that people are looking at very closely is whether or not these hearings have an impact on voters and on changing minds, particularly those who have supported Trump in the past. And there are differing reports on this, but there does seem to be some falling away from Trump. I'm not sure on which grounds or why, but I don't see him there in 2024, and I think we all have to do everything in our effort to try to reestablish a democracy in this country. And there are many ways it is fragile right now, not just the presence of Donald Trump.
Thanks for your call, Stephen. Let's take Mel in Middletown. Hi, Mel. Welcome to All of
yes,
It.
Yes, hi. Yeah, everything is informative, but people keep using the word deleted, and that's an incorrect term because it refers mostly to cell phones and messages and stuff that goes into your trash, which can be easily retrieved. This is more a coordinated process. I'm not quite sure how it's done, but you overwrite the information that so that it purposefully cannot be retrieved. sort of like the Black Redaction, it's not. I wish people would stop using the word deleted. It's not the proper word. It's been wiped clean it takes more action than just sliding it over to the trash bin.
Thanks for your call, Mel. Any thoughts on that, on the semantics of wiped clean?
Yeah, I think it's actually a good point. And I think because it just shows, it shows planning. It shows, thinking about what the consequences could be legally. It shows a frame of mind that suggests guilt. I think it's a very important point, and I thank him for making it.
Heather in Mount Kisco, welcome to All of It.
Hi. I want to follow up on the last caller with my question, because it does relate, that we also can just think about what can we expect in the way of norms and conduct of the Secret Service regardless of messages. So I'm going to Heather Cox Richardson's Substack analysis of July 21st, yesterday, where she writes, within 15 minutes of his speech, Trump had been informed that the Capitol was under attack and the White House knew some of the rioters were armed. Here she asks the question. This keeps tripping me up. If Secret Service agents knew there were weapons near the president, why on earth didn't they lock the place down rather than let the president just go back to the residence?
No, I read Heather Cox Richardson's thing this morning, and I think it's an excellent question. I think what we've seen, and I've written a lot about this, I think what we've seen is that, number one, mechanisms of accountability throughout the executive are weak. And need to be addressed. That would be one thing. Two, what is it? What can we expect in terms of checks on the president from those who work for him, and everybody from the head of the Secret Service to the Attorney General to others? Why is it so hard to cross that line to the president to say this is wrong? And to the deeper part of that statement in your question is, like, how many people were passively enabling this, whether they meant to or not? And again, I think the January 6th committee, which has done a great job with broad strokes, is pointing to so many important fissures within our government. And this is one of them. So thank you for bringing it up.
I wish we had a lot more time to talk about this. Our phone lines are have been absolutely full since you came on, Karen. And so clearly people want to talk about this. And it's an important topic that we need to have a dialogue about. Thank you so much for being here. Karen J. Greenberg is director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law. And I'm delighted to have had the chance to get to talk to you this afternoon.
Thank you so much.
And NPR will be talking about key takeaways from the hearing on All Things Considered. That's starting at 4 o'clock this afternoon on WNYC.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.